The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life, a life savings company for your journey to and through retirement.
With me this morning is Paddy Tobin, A2 leader, Gerard Howland, public affairs consultant and Irish Times columnist, and Noel O'Connell, former CEO of the European Movement.
Still there. A couple of months left.
We start with a story that is, it's becoming a bit of a hardy perennial, which is Cathal Berry being the lone voice in the wilderness saying, it might be nice to have some security around here, lads. Front of the Sunday Independent, our airports are easy targets for drone wars exports, say, experts say. This following the drone incursions in Dutch airports that caused so much, or rather Danish airports that caused so much problem last week. Their Prime Minister describing it as an attempt to shake the foundations of Europe, and Cathal Berry saying we continue to be largely undefended both in the air and at sea. Usually in these kind of things, Paddy Tobin, he is man alone saying this, isn't he?
Yeah, it is an incredible situation that at the moment we can float one naval ship, which is a shocking situation, that we've allowed the military depletes over so many years in terms of numbers. And I look back to the cyber attack, which cost 100 million euros, okay? The year before the cyber attack, this state spent 15 million euros on cybersecurity. One department, the Department of the Taoiseach, spent 15 million euros on press statements in the same year. Okay, so one department out of the 15 or so departments was spending the equivalent to the whole defence for cybersecurity in this country. So, you know, we talk at length in these shows about whether or not we should be part of a European defence union, you know, what role should we play in terms of partnership with NATO. But the very, very simple things in relation to our own defence, the government is not paying attention to whatsoever. And, you know, Eamon Ryan took...
Nor is public or political opinion. You almost get the sense that when it is discussed, there's a general sense of, go away, sure, we're not really at risk.
Well, I do think the problem with the depletion of the defence forces has been happening so long that it's one of those stories that build into the wallpaper, the background. So people know it's there, but it's been talked about so much that it doesn't fire people's attention as it should. But the fact is, you know, there's drug smuggling, there's people smuggling happening in this country as a result of the fact that we don't have ships that are able to provide security in our waters. There's no doubt in my mind that Ireland is extremely exposed in terms of our subsea cabling and our energy in relation to that. Like, do you remember back when the Russians parked themselves off the southwest of the country? It was actually the small fleet of Irish fishermen who actually went to the Russian embassy that negotiated that the Russians took off somewhere else in relation to that. So we do have a terrible weakness in terms of defending the very simple elements of our society. The way to do that is proper pay terms and conditions for the men and women who work in our defence forces, first of all, so the numbers increase, so we can put the ships on the sea, and also to make sure that we invest money in terms of cybersecurity and the likes of our airport, because, you know, this whole issue of being vulnerable to cybersecurity attacks is going to become a bigger issue into the future.
Why do we not take it seriously, Noel?
Well, I think we do, and we're going to have to take it seriously, Anton. It's interesting seeing the drone attack on Copenhagen and the Danish airports. Denmark holds the rotating EU presidency at the moment. So for the next 6 months, there's a lot of through traffic through Denmark. Ireland, next year, we're going to be holding the rotating EU presidency in the latter half of 2026. So for 6 months, there's going to be 250 meetings. There's going to be the largest ever political gathering in the state when the European political community comes to visit. That's up to 50 prime ministers, 50 leaders and their entourages here. So in terms of the passenger numbers coming through our airspace next year are going to be significant, and in the run up to it. And we have to take security and defence seriously. We can't be seen as the weak link on the security and defence side.
But we absolutely abdicate any responsibility to do so. I mean, we have one of the largest areas of sea to patrol, and we have one of the smallest navies of those who have a seaboard. We defer all airspace interdiction to the RAF. We have some of the greatest quantities of fibre optic cables coming through, and there is simply no defence over them whatsoever. There's no primary radar to know what's going on in the sky. Yeah. We sort of say, well, we are immune to what's happening to everybody else in Europe.
Yeah, and I think that's just not acceptable anymore in the increasing geopolitical challenging backdrop that we are facing, and we have to have these grown-up conversations. I mean, I think we're seeing, it's interesting, I did a podcast this week with General Sean Clancy, who is the chair of the EU Military Committee. So that's really interesting to see how they are linking in and kind of the transatlantic relationship, where all this plays out. But Ireland is going to have to step up to the plate, and we are going to have and continue to have very serious conversations about our security and defence commitments. You talk to any of my counterparts in the Balkan and the Baltic states, and the threat and the fear that they have in terms of living next door to a larger neighbour. We saw with Finland and Sweden, Finland sharing 1,200 kilometre border with Russia, you know. So these are conversations and discussions we are going to have to take. And I think Patter's point in terms of funding and supporting the 10 defence forces is critical. Now, we are seeing more proposals and more funding in the programme for government. And I know that was a common theme in the run-up to the election. But we have to be serious about this. We just can't be the weak link.
Why is it, do you think, Jared, is our, up until now, is our lack of commitment a sense that somehow it's a breach of our moral commitment to neutrality if we invest more?
Look, we've had a brilliantly successful defence policy for 100 years. We paid for nothing and nobody was interested and we got away scot-free. It's over. We are years behind, even with high levels of investment where we need to get to be. We're promised much higher investment starting now going forward. It'll be interesting to see if this government, year after year, and its successor, year after year, follows through on that commitment in circumstances where I think there will be increasing pressure on tax and spending. Will the political will be there for defence spending to support our neutrality, by the way? Because you're not neutral if you can't keep your front and back door locked. And that's one big test. And I think the other test, and Noel has said this in relation to us being one of 27, contrary to any Irish fantasies, NATO is not sitting by the phone waiting for us to join. The prospect is frankly risible and ridiculous. What there is growing levels of resentment, frankly, particularly in the East, in the Baltics, and in the Nordics, about our blinding indifference to what is an overwhelming existential concern for many of our fellow member states. And they remember very recently when we had a similar existential concern in Brexit, when we were stood by, and they ask increasingly forcibly, where are we in this? And this is not about neutrality or NATO. This is about us taking care of ourselves, our responsibilities in the water and in the air immediately around our own island.
Noel, I see you nodding your head to much of that.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with Jared. And, you know,
is that what you see from members and colleagues across the European movement?
Absolutely. 100%. When you talk to any of our counterparts, they point very successfully to Ireland's track record of being one of the, you know, one of the wealthiest countries in the EU. But with that wealth, with us being a net contributor to the EU budget, comes responsibilities and obligations. You know, I hear quite regularly, we provided solidarity to Ireland during the difficult, darkest moments in terms of Brexit. And there is a responsibility as part of our shared EU membership to support other EU member states. So, you know, I was struck talking to one of my colleagues in Estonia, and they talked about their grandparents having been forcibly removed to a gulag. And that's a very lived and real experience. And we have to be mature. We have to be responsible. And it's not ignoring our unblemished and incredibly proud peacekeeping track record. We're not talking about discarding that, but there is a responsibility to have a mature conversation. And I know, in fairness, with the Security and Defence Forum that the government did recently, we have gone around the country in terms of the Conference on the Future of Europe and seeing people actually having mature and robust conversations on our security and defence. But against the backdrop of a brutal Russian invasion in Ukraine, against the horrific situation that's going on in the Middle East, it is frankly, you know, not acceptable for Ireland to not step up to the plate. And I think there is more focus, there's more momentum, and there is a commitment to recognise our responsibilities. But we have to deliver on that. And that's going to, as Jared said, and it's interesting in terms of the budget being a couple of weeks down the track, where is the balance in terms of that? If we invest more in defence, where will the, you know, these are all really difficult decisions.
Interesting text saying, in the past, Ireland seemed to think its neutrality meant nobody would bother you, and it did. Ireland is no longer neutral on the world stage, and being unprepared now makes you a prime target. Another says, I've never understood what we're neutral about. It's time to revisit this.
Yeah, so first of all, we're militarily neutral. We're not morally neutral. So you can actually take positions on world affairs, for example, Gaza, without actually, you know, taking part in the military bloc. The reason why military neutrality has such a deep ingrained history in this country is because, as a small country, we know that if you partake in a military bloc, you tend not to be able to make adds to the decisions. So, for example, if we were to be involved in NATO, you know, we would not be deciding what NATO would do. We would be a very small cog in relation to the decision-making process, but we would have to send our men and women to those particular conflicts. And that's one of the reasons why small countries don't work well in military blocs, I believe. Secondly, I think that we have a competitive advantage and a competency in terms of peace. We have our own peace process. You know, we have sent peacekeepers across the world. You know, our missionaries have gone across the world. What actually we should be doing is exercising that competency in peace. In the same way, let's say, Norway does. It did.
Do we not sort of lose the run of ourselves with that? I mean, our peacekeepers have done very well where they have been deployed, but we are hardly globally significant.
We're not globally significant. But if you look at, for example, the Oslo Accord and the efforts that Norway made to try and get peace between Israel and Palestine, it shows that small countries can actually be catalysts for peace at times. Now, we've never exercised that muscle ever in relation to that. But the one thing I'd agree with here is, if you support peace, actually, that is more of an onus to actually invest in your own defence. Like, and neutrality doesn't mean that you don't have a defence force. Neutrality means actually you have a stronger defence force than if you were part of a military bloc, because you can't be neutral and completely be defenceless. So I would absolutely suggest that we need to significantly increase our investment in our own defence forces. But we should remain neutral, for sure.
Is it something, though, that when if you take going out on a canvas, if you're taking the political temperature, is it something that people actively believe is a real threat? I mean, you talked about the HSE, we discussed the HSE cyber attack. That undoubtedly led to people's deaths because of the impact it had on our capacity to deliver health services. But there is a sense of, oh, it was a once-off and an anomaly rather than the new norm.
So there's €100 million cost to that cyber attack, never mind the deaths that actually happened at that time. The problem is the political system in this country is a crisis-driven political system. Politicians are only interested in stuff when it's in the heat of the media's view. People ask me who's the strongest minister in this country, and I would say it's Minister Joe Duffy. So in other words, the government don't even listen to something unless it has a big impact in the media. And actually, that's the wrong way of doing things. Politicians shouldn't be focused on what's big in the media cycle for this week. There should be long-term focusing on the areas that we have to develop as a country. And that's one of the big weaknesses we have in the political system currently. So, you know, my view is that, you know, we in this country at the moment, there's no doubt we are extraordinarily exposed to the changes in the world's dynamics in terms of our own defence, our own technology, our own communications with the rest of the world, our own energy supplies with the rest of the world, and in terms of, you know, the HSE and our airports. And it's an incredible dereliction of duty for the government to completely still leave investment at the low levels that they're at, and have this contradictory discussion about how we should be actually really defending ourselves by joining up with a military bloc.
It strikes me as one of those, Jared, where in the future, if there is, hopefully there will not be, but if there is a significant cyber attack or anything along those lines, there will be an awful lot of pearl clutching and hand wringing and saying, why did nobody think of this in advance?
Well, there will be a significant cyber attack. There has been a significant cyber attack. This is the era we live in. So not happening is probably closer to fantasy than fact. In relation to if you wanted to, if powers, forces, I wanted to have a go at the United States of America, hitting them here economically in terms of pipes, wires and whatnots, would be the freest, easiest kick. You could do that far away from the mainland of the United States. Furthermore, if there is ever another European referendum here in which the progress across the European Union will be dependent on the outcome of that referendum here, which would have at least regional, if not global, significance, to what degree could we assure ourselves and the wider world that such a referendum could be conducted in a way that was not being manipulated or interfered with? And that is aside from ordinary common garden but blatantly black art and criminal interference in elections generally. And if you look at stuff that just soaking through these algorithms all the time, think, for example, of our presidential campaign. I know we're going to talk about that separately. And stuff that's out there.
Oh, it's fertile ground for culture wars, isn't it?
And that's just the new ordinary. Now, think of an extraordinary situation of an EU-related referendum. Think of a referendum on this island about future unity. All of these things are the real world. It's not George Orwell 1984, it is Ireland 2025.
And actually, sorry, Anton, if I'm just to follow on from Jared's point there, in terms of the election, we're seeing it play out in Moldova, right? Really susceptible to mis and disinformation from Russia. And, you know, today I was struck in looking at today.
You're seeing evidence of election interference or meddling.
Yeah, and it's a real serious concern. And, you know, if we think about the last EU referendum in Ireland was the 2012 Fiscal Stability Treaty referendum, probably a little bit before the whole social media and the algorithms kicked off.
Some of the flows of money through the campaigns on that were interesting to trace.
And listen, the next one is really going to be in a digital era. And, you know, today, the 28th of September, is World News Day. And it's the access and the International Day for Universal Access to Information. So these are critical underpinnings of our democracy.
So we've always had all our democracy has always up to now been analog. Well, I can remember years ago, the late Noel Whelan taking a stance against electronic voting. I thought electronic voting was great, by the way, right? And there are arguments for it. But in hindsight, in light of all this happening, I think the more analog ways we have to do our democracy, the better.
Tech saying, if you can't defend yourself, which we can't, then we don't have the luxury of being neutral in any shape or form. We need to take a break in a second. 53106 at a cost of 30 cents if you want to get in touch, or 087-1400-106. Before we go to the break, a story in the page 2 of the Sunday Times, Pather, that I think you may have a dog in the fight. The wrapping up of Children's Health Ireland, the continued investigations, inspections, whatever it may be, and the fact that it's now going to become part of the HSE, as I understand it, when the new children's hospital comes online. Is this a net positive thing, or does this allow for people who should be answerable to not be?
Yeah, so CHI had descended into dysfunction. We had obviously, you know, toxic management within CHI. We had money being spent without oversight. We had unauthorized springs being put into children. We had hundreds of children having operations that didn't meet the threshold for those operations. And of course, hundreds of children waiting for operations that they did need. Incredibly, right at the start of this year, 11.6 million was made available for operations, for children to go abroad for operations. As of today, no child is actually scheduled to go abroad for an operation at all. So we still have that dysfunction. 9 reports have been written into CHI and hundreds of recommendations, and no cohesion in terms of those recommendations being delivered. So the key element here is anything going to change by it being folded into the HSC? And, you know, I think there's no evidence of that yet. Jennifer Cara McNeill is new, and I think she has probably taken a stronger approach to some of these aspects than previous ministers. So we're going to give her a little bit of time in relation to this. But at the heart of this is the accountability element, right? So accountability is the key that actually makes people do their jobs properly. We all have to suffer accountability ourselves in our own jobs. But that accountability is missing within the HSE, and it is missing within government. I had a senior member of the Department of Health come into the Finance Committee that I was on in the previous stall, and I asked him, in the 40 years he's been in that department, had anybody lost their job in relation to something that went wrong in the HSE? And he said no, he's not aware of anybody who's lost their job in the HSE or the Department of Health in that 40 years. And I think that's still missing within this process. Like, how could you have the level of toxicity develop within the CHI and nobody being held responsible for it? How, you know, and I think this goes up to government level, and that we have ministers for health that remain immune to this accountability as well. And, you know, I know Simon Harris has had significant difficulties in terms of his home and the shocking and horrendous threats that have been made to him, which are unforgivable and wrong. But I still do believe that there's a necessity for parliamentary accountability to happen in relation to the fact that he hasn't ensured that these children get the operations in a timely fashion.
What about the bureaucratic shifting around? Because at this point, the structure of our health system seems to be cyclical. We have health boards, then we combine it into a unit as the HSE, then we go back to health boards. We have separate children's hospitals as part of the health boards, then we combine it into a unit as CHI, then we strip it back out and put them back into quasi-health boards. None of this seems to improve anything. We just go back and forth.
Yeah, so one of the difficulties here is change management sucks up an enormous amount of resources in its own basis.
It feels like activity.
So you're going to have change happening all the time and you're resourcing all this change and yet no money's going to the front line. And, you know, what we've said very clearly is that hospitals and the HSE and departments should be paid on the basis of the number of operations, treatments, engagements, therapies that they deliver to actual patients so that they can only bill the taxpayer for the number of individuals that they actually physically help. So like if you're in business, so you're in a shop or you're a service, you only get paid for the benefit you bring to a customer. And yet what we have in the HSE is the HSE gets paid no matter what happens. And the problem is that money gets lost in administration. It doesn't get to the front line. It balloons in terms of the amount of investment that's going into the HSE at the moment. And yet the results for the patients down the road don't seem to improve. And I think that's what we need to do.
On the subject of cash, did anybody put their hands in their pockets to the tune of €2,000 on Friday to see Barack Obama and Fintan O'Toole in conversation in the Three Arena?
No, I did not. But from friends and colleagues who were there, apparently some notable takeaways, as they say, was that he didn't mention President Trump once by name. He was asked at the start, are you still optimistic? Are you still hopeful? Is the message still, yes, we can? And an hour and a half later, I believe the message was still, yes, we can, but with some caveats against some of the challenges that the world is facing. I think the big focus was on democracy. And as well, he talked about how the EU could have stepped up more and done more in terms of some of the challenges that are facing globally, as opposed to regulating plugs, I believe, was something that I think was said. But I think it was, I wasn't there, but a hopeful event and a bit of an hour and a half of a conversation without mentioning.
He is clearly being very delicate, Jared, in what he regards as correct behaviour for a former president in not calling out any of the major flaws of the current administration. Is there a fine line between that and being sanctimonious?
Well, it is an American tradition, or it was until recently, that former presidents did not criticise the incumbents, and certainly you would never criticise the administration when you were abroad. It used to be considered extremely bad manners here, by the way, to criticise a minister or a Taoiseach while they were representing the country abroad. So we live in different times. But Obama is a young man, and he's one of a number of young men whose political peak is past tense. And what do they do for the next 40 years? And it's a problem I won't have.
The answer seems to be tour the world collecting
checks. And it's, at a certain point, it just becomes a bit stale. And I'm just not quite comfortable with this anymore. And on the other hand, when you see him, or indeed his wife Michelle, campaigning in the United States as they do, they're very effective campaigners, they're very eloquent speakers. They personally, I think, are decent people. I wish them well. But I think we live in an era where we are going to have a lot of ex-politicians who are going to, their ex-lives will be decades and decades on. And it's a problem.
But if they still have a voice and if they still have relevance, as Obama clearly does, if he's going to fill the Three Arena, I mean, an awful lot of people showed up to hear what he said. Is there not a moral obligation on him, particularly when he can do it during campaigns, to call out what he undoubtedly believes to be egregious behaviour of an administration, even if you don't tarnish the existing president?
There is, and he didn't, and he does so, I think, in other ways. But this essentially is a product. He was selling a product. He was selling brand Obama. This was, it's like selling T-shirts and hats and other stuff. That's what he was asked. Let's call it out for what it is.
You had no desire to go home.
No, I think it's a pity, because obviously Obama came to the political foreground on the basis that he was part of nearly a revolution where the common people, the average man and the woman, were actually taking the reins of power. And, people really felt that happening when he got elected. And really what we see now is a person commercializing that political capital that he had developed over that period of time. And like, I come from, I suppose, the strain of politics where you're a political activist. So what you do is, no matter what you, where you're at, you pull the political levers you can to make change for the better. And, you know, I think that he has built that political capital. I think he should be spending it in terms of trying to improve where we are in the world at the moment. I suppose my worry to a certain extent
is... Does he not earn a certain level of quasi-retirement? Is he not able to say, my race is run, I gave all to public service, and if I want to have innocuous chats with Fintan O'Toole for hundreds of thousands of euros, let me at it.
I think he's like, that'd be okay if he was at home on the farm, you know, looking after the chickens to a certain extent, but he's monetizing his political capital currently instead of expending his political capital for the better. And I just think it's not something that, you know, draws admiration. Is quite the opposite. It's a pity in those terms. But I do often think, you know, what if Obama was in the White House now? What if Biden was in the White House now? What difference would it make to world events? And while I think that the language would be completely different, obviously, in terms of Gaza than Trump's administration, and they probably would be working behind the scenes a little bit more sharply with the Netanyahu administration, I possibly think that Netanyahu would be still on the war path that he is in currently, even if the Democrats were there. And like, so for example, before Obama left office, you know, the language is all about we're close to a peace process, but yet the Yanks were signing a blank check to Israeli actions in Gaza. And, you know, I think that's one of the weaknesses with the Democrats. They didn't differentiate themselves enough in terms of the Republicans on those terms.
Which is a point that you were making during the break about Obama never having really stood up to Netanyahu.
Well, he did stand up to Netanyahu, and he was pushed right back on his heels by Netanyahu, who famously did two things that no other Israeli leader had done previously, but is now a new normal. Israeli statecraft in the United States was based on bipartisan politics. And Netanyahu stood up to Obama successfully by saying, "Feck you, mate. Republicans are my friends. I'm going to play this card." He accepted an invitation from a Republican Congress to address the Houses of Congress in defiance of President Obama, got away with it, and it worked for him in his terms for quite some time. And it's still the track he's on in the United States. And look at his Trump relationship.
While we're on the topic of Trump and the new administration, Noel, there's a discussion in a lot of the media this morning about, remember Simon Harris had said that he would either be positively disposed towards or okay with Donald Trump coming. Apparently Micheál Martin is the same. If he wants to address the Houses of the Oireachtas while he's over here, he's more than welcome.
Well, I think that would be an interesting address. Obviously, I think, as the Taoiseach said, obviously, President Trump is the President of the United States. We recently celebrated a very significant diplomatic anniversary between our two countries. And I think, in fairness, respect to the leader of the United States from a protocol side of things. But I think it would be a long, possibly, speech. And I know the Taoiseach talked about how managing the responses pattern might have some thoughts and views on that. 10 or 11 interventions. We've seen a lot of, obviously, recent leaders address the Houses of the Oireachtas. And I think it is normal protocol. But, you know, in terms of President Trump's recent speech at the UN this week, it was just...
At what point do we get close to Edmund Burke here and good men doing nothing?
Well, I suppose I'm from the Good Friday Agreement school of politics, in that you do speak to people you disagree with and you do engage with people you disagree with on a range of issues.
You platform them in front of your Houses of Parliament.
Well, I think that's the Good Friday Agreement shows that actually if you want to achieve peace, if you want to achieve if you want to persuade people of something, you know, standing and ignoring them or protesting and ignoring them doesn't actually achieve that in a parliamentary fashion. And while I would disagree with definitely what's happening in Gaza and the underwriting of it by the United States, I still think we have to talk to the leader of the US and we have to try and persuade him of our views. We are very...
But are those things mutually exclusive? Is it possible to have a diplomatic dialogue without... I mean, if you look at the UK state visit, where you lay on the pomp and the pageantry and the gold carriages, you have no doubt but that will play in America as not only acceptance but admiration. Do you do the same?
I think the Brits involve themselves in that probably for more economic terms. I think that they, you know,
for sure, will we?
Yeah, and that's going to be like, and it is a fact of matter too. Like, we have 200,000 people working in the in the FDI section here. So, like, the question is, we have a moral duty to make sure that we have a positive impact on these international questions, if we can. How do we exert as much moral influence as possible? Do we do it by banning, you know, the leader of the free world speaking at the Dáil, or do it by trying to persuade? I think it's the latter, and I think that's we've no other option but to do that.
We're down a rabbit hole here. The state visit was a completely controlled forum. There was no speech to the House of Parliament in Westminster because it would have been an uncontrollable cattle mart. If I were Micheál Martin, I would say, too, I would welcome President Trump addressing the House of Rockness, and I would work very hard to explaining to him why it absolutely should not happen, and I don't think it will happen, and I don't think it's real politics.
He might spend more time watching the Ryder Cup in Adair Manor.
Can we not just get him out to Bono's gaff? It seems that everybody who comes over has dinner with Bono. Apparently Obama was out on Friday night having... he wouldn't go around out of the Shelburne to receive the freedom of the city, but he came out to Dalkey for the dinner with Bono. In other news, RTE has a difficult challenge, apparently, to fill the hole left by David McCullough. And meanwhile, there is discussion that Kevin Backhurst, the DG, may be in for a €50,000 pay hike on top of the €337,000 total package that he currently receives. He's quoted, I think, in the paper, or RTE is quoted, Jared, as saying that this is still up for discussion and therefore nobody has landed on a position. Can the DG take a pay rise while shouting about pay cuts for everybody else?
Well, if you're slashing other people's money and jobs, you possibly feel you deserve something in return for it. I have to say, I don't have a particular obsession with Kevin Backhurst's pay. Clearly, RTÉ, you know, overstaffed, overindulged, overpaid in many ways, and not particularly well run for years and years. How does it go forward? What's the recipe? The state, we the people, have a real vested interest in not just RTÉ as a public service broadcaster, but other licensed broadcasters, including News Talk, Virgin Television, who are part of, you know, the ether of public service broadcasting. And that's not recognised enough at all, frankly. And the failure of anything remotely resembling a media policy underlines that. But to answer the question, it's a decision for RTÉ whether their main man is worth an extra $50,000. And it's for that board to make that decision, to make the case to the government, and then, as it inevitably would be, to make the case in front of a parliamentary committee who will ask that question.
So what the Sunday Times is reporting is that under new government pay structures, pay bans for top-level executives in commercial state companies could rise to a maximum of €300,000. And given the additional car support and pension support, that would put... if you got the totality, that would put Kevin Backhurst up at around like 300.
See, it's incomprehensible to people whose earnings are, you know, a tiny fraction of 250,000. How somebody on 250,000 would want nearly 300,000. But at the level where big organisations are looking for the right people, those are the numbers that those people are looking for. And there are issues and incidents about retaining and getting the right talent at that sort of
but
big money.
You could make that was the argument.
Not necessarily
made
for RTÉ, by the way.
No, but that was the argument that was for made commercial presenters, that if you wanted a Ryan Tuberty or wanted a Pat Kenny, you had to pay £1 million. And what Kevin Backhurst said, not at all, sure, I can get it for 250. Well, can't the same argument be applied to Kevin Backhurst?
So the government won't... Like we have doctors and we have nurses, we have teachers, we have Gardaí who are either leaving the profession or not being employed because of the pay terms and conditions are not enough to get them in there. And the government make a very solid argument, no, we can't raise these wages because, you know, it would upset the whole, you know, very delicately created public pay process. And yet, when it comes to these types of jobs, there seems to be a different argument made. So the €50,000 increase is an increase above the total average pay in this country, which is quite incredible. So, you know, I do think that in a organization that's looking for 400 more redundancies on the basis that there is a need to, you know, tighten the screws in expenditure, it does not make sense for this pay rise to happen. I think Backhurst has done a reasonable job in actually steadying the RTÉ ship currently, but there's a long way to go here. And I would agree with the point here that we actually have to get into a situation where it becomes more commercially feasible, and also that public broadcasting fund actually starts to be spread more evenly across some of the public broadcasters that are in competition with RTE? Because we have a big problem with media in this country. Like, RTE is a monolith in terms of, you know, the other organisations. And we only have about six national media companies currently.
Yeah.
And that doesn't lead to a diversity of views and a competition of ideas in the media section, which actually has a big influence on what's happening in politics too.
And the primary purpose of media, of course, is absolutely not national security. But in the age of the algorithm, sound authoritative media is an essential part of national security. And we're not willing to pay. You know, newspapers and whatnot and the news sections of the independent radio and television, as indeed of RTE, it is not commercial. We the people are not prepared to pay some sort of media charge, it seems. Our politicians are not prepared to challenge us to pay it. And there should be. There needs to be.
Front of the Irish Independent, picture of Maria Steen and her husband Neil at their home in Dublin under the quote, "I learned a lot about politics this week." She's talking about the process of trying to get the nomination for candidacy. And in it, she reveals that we as a nation failed her handbag test. The handbag was some way to see if we, I don't know, we're okay with the rich. Was that what
it was? A lady friend of mine, we had this conversation with a lady friend of mine, and she said, just stop yourself right there. There's a lot of fellas walking around town with watches as expensive or more so than that, and nobody says boo. So I thought that was telling. But I really thought it would have been a very good idea, good for the country, to have Maria Steen nominated as president.
Why?
But I've changed my mind.
Oh.
And I've changed my mind since she didn't get the nomination, because I feel I found out more about her since in how she's handled that and what she said. And I feel I discern a sense of entitlement and aggrievement, both of which are entirely unjustified. She, who, as I say, I thought should have a nomination. It would broaden the debate. Her handling and articulation and some of those adjacent to her of the failure to get the nomination has certainly disillusioned me.
But if those are the kind of characteristics that would make you not want to vote for her as president, is it not nonetheless a good thing that she has the chance to display them to the nation in a campaign rather than be shut out at the starting gate?
No, I think the fact is, it's not that she was shut out. And I really challenge that language. Stopped, blocked, shut out. She didn't get support. It's the famous line that David Andrews once used years ago about a Fianna Fáil TD who lost a seat in Dunleary. Why? He didn't get enough votes. Now, we just need to cop on here.
But it's a particular electorate, though,
grip, right?
It is a gerrymandered electorate.
No, it's not. That really stopped the lights. If you're Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Labour, Social Democrat, and you're supporting one or other candidate... No, AIM2, is different. They have own different position. I'm speaking of the parties behind the three candidates, right? Okay. None of those councillors or AUCTUS members were under any obligation, and it would have been daft of them to support Maria Steen or another. And in relation to independent or AUCTUS members who did not support her, who are somehow being accused of some treachery to something, this really is nonsense. They're under no obligation to support somebody they wouldn't vote for or didn't believe in.
But that's my point.
In.
Is that not by an the way, unusually high bar?
Some of those
bar?
People, some of those, no, it's not an unusually high bar. We have a very accessible, porous nomination system for the office of president. It's relatively easy to get a nomination. And if Miss Steen...
Not according to Miss Steen, not according to Gareth
Sheridan. And that's because she's wrong.
So can I come in there just briefly? So there is a democratic deficit in this particular election. There is no doubt about that. We have a... Like, this presidential election should be a competition of ideas. It should be a situation where pretty much most large sections of our society should have a horse in the race that is articulating their views. Now, you know, all of us recognise that Ireland has become a slightly polarised place, like other countries, over the last while. There is a section of society who feels that there isn't that their views are not visible within that marketplace of ideas at the moment. And I think the decisions that we made in the last week actually make that worse. And that's an issue. Now, in terms of the threshold for the presidential election, there is no threshold like it. So the local elections, the Dáil elections and the European elections, very low threshold. Most people can get on the ballot and then most people can have a choice in relation to this. This has an extraordinarily high threshold. It was built in 1937 for a two-party system. And In actual fact, the reason why the threshold has worked to a certain extent in recent years is because Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael did not dictate to their councillors to block at council
level.
Now,
hang on for a minute, Padraig. The expression writ large across Gerard's face suggests that he wants to counter you.
No, if you're a member of a party, right, okay, and you can speak for AIM too, I wouldn't presume to, right? And the party takes a position. The reasonable expectation is that the party's elected representatives will be of that ilk in councils in the Oireachtas. So, for example, if you take a policy position as the leader of AIM 2 on a particular issue, without me double-checking, I assume your own AIM 2 colleagues are of the same mind.
Well, you would assume that, but look at Fianna Fáil, for example, right? So Fianna Fáil selected Jim Gavin. Well, I corrected. Micheál Martin selected Jim Gavin above the heads of 40% of his own TDs, never asked his councillors what they thought, never asked the membership what they thought, and that's a problem. Secondly, in the last election, 2011, Enda Kenny quite clearly said, my councillors are able to abstain. We will not block anybody at council level. And that was his words. Simon Harris took a defensive purpose because they didn't want Maria Steen on the actual ballot, and he said they must block. Micheál Martin said, you know, something similar, read between the lines, thou shalt not support another candidate. So as a result, we have a really tight system, which, like, I'll give you an example. Like, David Norris was on 19% in the polls in 2011, and he couldn't get a nomination. Now, any nomination procedure that is blocking someone that has a fifth of the support of the population is wrong. It is anti-democratic.
Well, look, the president is the highest office in the land, and notwithstanding the merits of that, as a voter, if I can be very honest and say, as a voter, as somebody, you know, who is a politics junkie, the European Parliament elections, the ballot paper read over 27 candidates. I mean, speaking honestly, there's three. It's not as many in terms of representing maybe the plurality and diversity of views, but that bar and that threshold should be high in terms of our presidential candidate. What I am concerned about is the potential for low voter turnout, though. I think Mandy Johnson in the Business Post had an interesting article, and I think Brenda Power in the Times as well. You know, they're saying about 40%, if even, voter turnout.
Sure.
Hashtag, you know, what's the hashtag? Spoil the vote. So this is really, really worrying. We don't get that opportunity.
Why?
Because to elect a president and only, you know, less than 40% of the people turning out to even care to vote. Like, that right to vote for me is something that was hard fought, hard won. We should cherish it. We have a responsibility, I think.
You're dead right. The law will be fulfilled. The Constitution will be fulfilled. All those boxes will be ticked. But will the democratic legitimacy box be fully ticked here? You know, there is the idea that a president will be elected by 35-40% of the population on the back of this is a poor reflection of a democracy. It is bad democracy. And actually,
this is a non-executive position.
But here's the thing, right? So everybody's giving out about what's happening outside, the stresses, the polarisation. We as a political class have a responsibility to make the parliamentary political system work. And the only way we can make it work is to make sure that voices are heard. Democracy is a pressure valve for some of the stresses and strains that happen in a society. But if people feel excluded from that democratic race, well, then that pressure valve doesn't operate and it gets worse.
So
and
Padder is saying it right. There is a democratic deficit. Mm. I accept that. There are a lot of people with views similar to Maria Steen's who feel they have no voice. Mm. That's right. And it's also wrong for the reasons you've outlined, mm. right? Separately, this presidential election is a box of wet matches. Enthusiasm and interest is very low. That may change. But finally, to come back to Maria Steen, there was a pool of Oireachtas members who are not otherwise committed, who could not be persuaded, who did not, which was absolutely their entitlement, and to relay that afterwards as some sort of blocking or conspiracy or something, that diminishes her in my mind.
Just on that
she
point.
Would have been better off not going down that
You got about 30 seconds, Padraig.
So what I found weird about this was there was a pool of about six TDs and senators, all very aligned to each other, in the orbit of Michael McDougall, to be honest, who wouldn't even answer the telephone for a period of weeks in relation to having a discussion. Now, common decency is you answer, you say, no, I won't, maybe I will, or yes, I will. But there was a refusal to even engage with the Steen camp on that. And that's what I found really strange. Some of those, mind you, were on exactly the same ideological ground as Maria Steen. There wasn't a cigarette paper and the difference between, let's say, the likes of Noel Grealish, Sean Canny, Victor Boyne, Gerard Crockwell with Maria. But yes, they wouldn't answer the phone.
But that's for them to say.
No, but
that's
it
for
is,
them
but,
to decide. They have their own mandate.
It is unusual that would happen.
Independent means independent.
Text to say, Maria Steen's arrogance is astonishing. After failing to start a campaign in time to get the nomination, she's now attacking our democratic system instead of having the decency to put her hand up and admit she got it wrong. Another, I fully agree with Jared Howland. I too felt Steen might have added something to the balance of candidates, but since she failed to rally sufficient support, the sense of entitlement she's shown
I don't think
is
it's entitlement.
Breathtaking.
It's an anger at the system and a desire to seek the system.
If she's really interested in public service, let her run for a local council or a Dáil seat next time around. I wouldn't rule that out, given what she's talking about in some of the papers today.
I think she'd make a fine senator.
Guys, thank you so much. Padraig Tobin, Aintu leader, Jared Howland, public affairs consultant and Irish Times columnist, and Noel O'Connell, CEO of the European Movement in Ireland.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.